The next item on the program is a presentation entitled Legal and Constitutional Aspects of Abortion. In the introductory remarks, which I made, I indicated that we were going to zero in on two special aspects of the whole life concerns area. One of those was the ethical perspective. The second is the constitutional legal perspective. We feel we have one of the most competent speakers in the country to speak to us on this issue. As I indicated earlier, Mrs. Garden has testified before both the Senate subcommittee and the House subcommittee. She's been very active in life concerns areas for a number of years now. Her husband is a pastor in the English district in New Jersey, and we're delighted to have Mrs. Garden here and to look forward to her presentation.
Always chide Sam about saying things like that, and I think he does it just to get my Irish up, but today I'm particularly embarrassed when he says she is one of the best known something or other in the country, in the light of the fact that we have experts on our Social Concerns Committee who are here to hear that. So I'm very embarrassed, Sam. I have sheets for you to distribute after I'm finished, if you care to have one, outlining the things we'll be talking about today and listing some of the dates that may kind of get jumbled up as we move along. No one, opponent or proponent of abortion on demand, ever expected the sweeping decision handed down by the Supreme Court on January 22, 1973. Quickly, however, various groups endorsed the decision, and some began to take credit for it. The Playboy Foundation, in its annual report, detailed its extensive involvement in what it called the movement which won a major court victory, stating that it had been involved in seeking to liberalize the abortion law since 1966. The Humanist Manifesto was soon published after that decision, Manifesto number 2, endorsing abortion on demand, and stating, or having it signed by, some of the recognized pro-abortion leaders in the country. Lawrence Lader, president of NARAL, the National Association for Repeal of Abortion Laws, and Alan Guttmacher, the late president of Planned Parenthood. And just last summer in Philadelphia at the annual NOW convention, Karen DeCrow was asked about abortion on demand through the ninth month, and did she feel that that was what feminists wanted, and she said, of course it is. It's what we work for. So many are very, very happy about that decision, but opposition to the decision occurred even more quickly, beginning before the ruling was made public and coming from within the court itself. Justice White, joined by Justice Rehnquist in dissenting opinions, said this: the court chose to value the convenience, the whim, or caprice of the mother more than the life or potential life of the fetus. And the court thereby allows a woman abortion on demand for any reason or no reason. The court, he states, simply fashions and announces a new constitutional right for pregnant mothers, which he characterizes as an exercise of raw judicial power. In between these two positions, of course, are most people having an opinion of the opinion, but really not knowing clearly what that opinion says. And so stripping away all of the legalese, which will be very painful for you on our committee, perhaps the essence of it has been most clearly articulated through the words of the kids of the Peanuts comic strip. Charlie Brown says to Lucy, "What's this I hear about you throwing Linus out of the house? That's not legal, you know. He's part of your family. Legally, you can't throw him out." "Oh, yes, I can, and I did," says Crabby Lucy. "Legally, a big sister can throw out a younger brother because she's bigger than he is and because he bugs her all the time. And she can do it, and I did it. And if you're smart, Charlie Brown, you won't get involved." And Charlie Brown, with a wide-eyed, simple look on his face, says, "Oh, I'm very smart." On January 22, 1973, the Crabby Lucy philosophy became the law of the land, and we can now eliminate those in the human family who are smaller than we are simply because they bug us. That's not what the court intended to do. That's not what they thought they did. But 3 years later, playing Monday morning quarterback, that's exactly what they did. I hope you can. Whoops. You got a little wrinkle coming from New Jersey. Beginning with the Constitution, Justice Blackmun, who wrote the majority opinion, said that since the right to privacy is nowhere specifically mentioned in the Constitution, obviously the Constitution was intended to cover that concept, that right. On the other hand, he said, since the unborn are nowhere specifically mentioned in the Constitution, obviously the Constitution was not intended to cover them. Where then is the right to privacy located? Well, he thought perhaps in the Fifth Amendment or the Ninth Amendment, but he concluded it was in the 14th Amendment that it was most clear. That amendment says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor be denied the equal protection of the law. You will recall that the 14th Amendment came into being to strike down a previous Supreme Court decision, also a 7-2 decision, in 1857, the Dred Scott decision declaring that blacks were not legal persons but were property. So the amendment established to grant legal personhood to one segment of the human family now becomes the basis for denying it to another segment of the human family. And it's interesting to see the similarities in reasoning between these two decisions. Justice Taney in 1857 said, "Well, at the time of the Declaration of Independence, at the time of the writing of the Constitution, nobody thought about blacks as being persons." Part of the decision said this, "They have for more than a century been regarded as beings of an inferior order. They had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. This opinion at that time was fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race. Since they were not considered persons 100 years previously, there was no reason," Justice Taney said, "to consider them persons in 1857, and the court declared that they would be property." And he pointed also to the census in which blacks were not counted as full persons. Justice Blackmun used the same reasoning, again pointing to the census, saying, "Well, we've never counted fetuses in a census," and indicating that at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, no one understood person to include the unborn. But he doesn't at any time consider that perhaps in 200 years, medical and scientific evidence would cause us to reconsider our understanding of person. Instead, he points to the opinion of the pagans way back, and he points to our understanding 200 years ago, and remains fixed in that understanding. I'd better do this from the microphone. There are some pertinent dates that we ought to consider in relation to this decision. In 1827, the facts of conception were first discovered. As a result of that discovery, medical people began to reevaluate their understanding of the unborn. The American Medical Association set up a committee to investigate abortion. And in 1857, at their 12th National Convention, this committee said in their report that they believed they were expressing the unanimous position of physicians, that based on medical evidence, and they had none of what we have today, or very little, I should say, based on what they did know at that time, they said that abortion was the wanton and murderous destruction of a child. And they passed a resolution unanimously to oppose abortion except to save the life of the mother or the life of the child. They also passed a resolution directing state medical societies to go home and seek to bring the law in their states into conformity with this medical position. So we have 1827, the facts of conception. 1827. 1859, the AMA passes this resolution. The state medical societies quickly got to work, and by 1866, there were many strong anti-abortion laws on the books, and Congress passed an assimilative crime statute, which endorsed the existing anti-abortion laws. 1866 and 1868 comes the 14th Amendment. It would appear there is no evidence that none of the anti-abortion laws were challenged. Certainly none were struck down with the passage of the 14th Amendment. There is no indication that the men who wrote the amendment, who also passed the assimilative crime statute, the Congress which proposed it, or the states which ratified it, ever intended the 14th Amendment to legitimize abortion on demand. If that right is found in the 14th Amendment, it has escaped the notice of everybody for 100 years, until Justice Blackmun recently found it. The court did some interesting things with the word person. Human being is a biological concept. We can establish humanness through genetics. We can establish beingness through scientific criteria. But human person, according to the court, and human being and human person in the legal sense are not synonymous. The court rejected the biological concept and opted for a sociocultural definition of person in which are operative norms such as capable of meaningful life, a person in the full sense, a person in the whole sense, and unwanted. These need not be protected by law. The state has no compelling interest in such, said the decision. The court opted for a developmental view of humanity. It said at some point, life becomes human. It talks about potential life, never full life until after birth. The question then is, could life at some time cease to be human when it is no longer capable of meaningful life or a person in the full sense or wanted. If the unborn is not a person in the whole sense, is it therefore not a person in any sense? And the court said yes. Legal personhood is conferred by society. Legal persons are corporations, trade unions, ocean-going vessels. We heard earlier when Pastor Nasker talked about Dr. Watson, who says on the basis of that decision, it would only be fair to extend legal life or to establish legal life at 3 days after birth, during which time the born would be subjected to a number of tests. If it did not meet the criteria, it would not be protected by law. HEW, last summer, in lifting its ban on fetal research, created a new category of being. It's called fetus ex utero. This is a child that has been aborted and living, but outside of the womb. It cannot be protected by the law because no fetus, by this decision, can be a person. If we had the same situation and the child would be wanted, we would say that's a premature baby, premature infant. Now in abortion, they are called fetus ex utero, and therefore, under the guidelines of fetal research, do not receive the full protection of the law. The concern for many, as a result of the distinction the court made between human being and legal person, is that if we can kill a human being before he reaches meaningful existence, will we be able to kill a person after he has passed meaningful existence, and who is to define what is meaningful existence? One need only define the word person in such a way as to include the desired quality of life, and you can eliminate all others from the law's protection who are unwanted of any age or condition, because such a concept of person is capable of meaningful expansion. The court also in this decision expanded the meaning or the understanding of the word health, stating that it would interpret that word in a very broad sense, and it opted for the definition given by the World Health Organization, which says health is a state of complete mental, physical, and social well-being, not merely the absence of sickness or disease. If a woman is pregnant and is not experiencing well-being or happiness about that pregnancy, she is not enjoying health. And the court gave us some examples of when this would occur. If the pregnancy burdened her or others in any way, if she was distressed by the idea of being pregnant, if child care might tax her, or if she were embarrassed because perhaps she was not married. Justice Douglas, in his concurring opinion, said her health would be threatened if it interfered with her preferred lifestyle. Justice Douglas also said in his concurring opinion that pregnancy is caused by the vicissitudes of life. Wouldn't you think a man his age would know better than that? But he assessed the situation correctly because, medically speaking, The court said that an unwanted pregnancy is a disease. In one of the very earliest cases after the Supreme Court decision, the Friendship Medical Center against the Chicago Board of Health pleaded its case by saying it was giving medical care because pregnancy is a disease, the cure for which is removal. Last summer, the United States Public Health Service, at the joint annual meeting of its professional associations, put out a press release in which it called unwanted pregnancy the second most prevalent sexual disease, second only to VD. It said that unwanted pregnancy qualifies as a sexual disease because, like venereal disease, it is socially and emotionally a pathologic condition. It is transmitted through the sexual route. It has an incubation period before the initial symptoms appear. It occurs primarily in the most sexually active age groups. And it appears to have a familial predisposition. Pregnancy has become a treatable venereal disease. And in some hospitals in Pittsburgh, I know of firsthand, it is so recorded on the medical records. The court divided pregnancy into three trimesters. These are not scientific or medical divisions. In the first trimester, from fertilization until about the 13th week, the court said that no state may prohibit abortion for any reason. The only requirement is that the woman make her decision to have an abortion in consultation with a doctor. But in the cases which have followed, we have indicated that in those first 3 months, the abortion need not even be performed by a physician, and it can be done anywhere. In the fourth, fifth, and sixth months, no state may prohibit abortion. A woman can have any reason or no reason. Again, the one stipulation is that she make her decision in consultation with a doctor. But the court said at this time a state might have an interest in the woman's health. It might, and it may set up requirements stating who is to do the abortion and where, but the state need not. And then in the last trimester, up until the moment of birth, the court said, at this point, a state may have an interest in the potential life. It need not, but it may. And it may prescribe abortion under certain circumstances. But if a pregnant woman claims that the pregnancy threatens her health, and you will recall the expanded definition of health, then no state may deny her an abortion. And so we have, in fact, and in practice, abortion on demand up until the moment of birth. Those who are interested in modifying or nullifying or limiting the Supreme Court decision have been active in three areas. One is in seeking federal legislation, whereby the Congress could address itself to some of the problems created by this decision. The second area of activity is the development of alternatives to abortion. The whole system is set up to quickly abort a woman. There are government funds, there are government agencies, there are all kinds of social agencies. There is no problem with a woman today finding she's pregnant and tomorrow being aborted. There is not that support system for the woman who wants to have her child, who sees abortion as the least desirable solution, but there is not a support system whereby she has a viable option. And then the third area of activity has been in the constitutional amendment area. Pastor Nasker mentioned hearings held in the Senate in February of 74. No amendment was reported out of that committee. And this past March, a few hearings were held in the House. There has been no action and no report about which way that committee is going to go. Basically, there are two types of amendments. One is a human life amendment, which would declare the unborn a person. The purpose of this amendment would be to restore a constitutionally compelling identity between the biological category human being and the legal concept of person. It would secure protection not only for the unborn, but for the mentally retarded, the handicapped, and the many who are finding themselves in jeopardy. The states' rights amendment would restore the power to the states, and each state would then determine under which circumstances and at which time it would protect unborn life. A state's rights amendment on the civil rights issue, for instance, on slavery, would have meant that certain states would have permitted slavery and others would not have. Those who are involved in this activity see the state's rights amendment as a less desirable route to follow. The problems which have arisen since the decision are many because the court did not address itself to some aspects of the abortion question. And I'd like to conclude today by mentioning some of those. And what exists in our country varies from state to state, so I'll speak rather broadly. First is spousal consent, the father's rights. No father, since the Supreme Court decision, has been able to save his child from an abortion. The woman's right is so absolute. Florida, one of the first states to tackle this question, ruled that since the state had no interest to protect the fetus as a result of the Supreme Court decision, the state could not create an interest on behalf of the father. Some say, is then the male, the husband, just a fertilizer? What are his rights to beget and to raise children? Are they rights just in theory? Because if a state cannot secure those rights for him, are they his rights indeed? What will this situation do eventually to the marriage, that fragile bond? What effect will this situation have on the family? Second area of concern is parental consent, which has been ruled unconstitutional for a minor in many states. Minors may be tested for pregnancy and receive abortions without parental consent, in many cases without parental knowledge. But the parents of minors are liable for any expenses incurred in that procedure. Minors cannot get their ears pierced without parental consent. They cannot get an aspirin from the school nurse without parental consent. In Delaware, they can't play bingo in public without parental consent, but they can be aborted. What effect will this situation have on parental responsibility and parental authority? Third, there is a growing evidence of abortion clinic abuses. I serve on a committee set up by the New Jersey State Senate, which is to investigate abortion clinics, and it is impossible to even communicate what is going on in what essentially are back alley abortion clinics, which have been brought to the front alley. The problems result from the fact that abortioners are not subject to peer review. They need not give informed consent as to what procedure will be followed, what the possible complications are, or what the alternatives are to the procedure. Profiteering and kickbacks have become common practice. And when we were down at the House hearings, we read testimony which documented the number of instances where women had taken in male urine to see what would happen. They got back a positive that that male was pregnant. Reporting is incomplete. It's unobtainable. We can't get the records from the abortion clinics in New Jersey. Original abortion clinics had been required to be close to a hospital to deal with emergencies and to have backup blood supplies for hemorrhaging. These have been ruled unconstitutional. In New Jersey, a freestanding clinic can open its doors after it has met the fire, the zone, and sanitation code. It need meet no other requirements. What effect will this situation have on the public health when legal abortion clinics are almost as unregulated as back alley abortion clinics? Fourth, a rise in the use of abortion in place of contraception. Planned Parenthood lists abortion as a birth control method and stated in their recent study on contraception, abortion, once considered a relatively hazardous procedure, is now so safe that it is increasingly being used as a routine birth control method. If a woman were to use only abortion as a birth control measure, she could expect to have about 20 abortions in her lifetime. What is the effect physically and emotionally on women who undergo abortions? In a report of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists at their 75 convention, they stated that deaths and near deaths had occurred with every type of abortion procedure, and it found the most serious complications occurring in teenage girls. They stated in this report that abortion is the only surgical procedure in which the surgeon doesn't see his complications. With no complete or accurate reporting throughout the country, it is impossible to assess the morbidity or mortality rate connected with the legal abortion procedure. Fifth, the problem of live births resulting from late abortions. In the hysterotomy method, for instance, which is used in late abortions, the child is always born alive, and then the problem comes, what do you do with it? And of course, many times it's just killed, but even more seriously is the fact that these are the babies being made available for medical experimentation which does not have the guidelines that experimentation has on cats and dogs and monkeys. And these fetuses are being made available without the mother's knowledge in most cases or consent. Sixth, mandated public funding of abortion. HEW, in accord with the Supreme Court decision, in 73 alone provided tax funds for 278,000 abortions, costing the taxpayers in 1 year alone $50 million. Our state has just ruled that the 8 weeks unemployment compensation which is given to a woman who delivers a child must now, because of the decision, be paid to women who elect to have abortions. So we're told that this is a quick 5-minute lunch hour procedure. You're back to work in a couple of hours. But in New Jersey, you can collect 8 weeks disability benefits for that. Seventh, what effect will the situation have on the medical profession as it returns to the pre-Hippocratic oath days? A way of medicine that has existed now for 2,400 years, which was unique because it separated the healer from the exterminator. In rejecting the Hippocratic Oath, we have again combined these two into one. There was just a ruling in Los Angeles County that physicians need not inform the woman seeking an abortion of the biological facts of the fetus. She has no right to this knowledge, Los Angeles County ruled. And so someone has said, what effect will that have on the quality of medicine and on the medical profession itself as it practices no-fault medicine? And finally, the law teaches, if the unborn have no value because they're unwanted, society will soon come to see abortion as a good, a cure, seemingly, for a problem. What effect will that cure have on the psyche of a society? I believe, as I've been involved in this issue, and it's a messy issue, and it's very hard to be pleasant or even kind of lighthearted in some instances about it, because it is so serious. Yet I'm concerned to already see some of the spillover in other areas, a general degrading of life, which, as Dr. Allen says, affects all of us. There are four areas I'd just briefly like to mention. A few weeks ago in the Washington Star, the William Buckley column was entitled, Madam, Can You Spare a Placenta? And he went on to tell about how the cosmetics industry is gobbling up, in his words, the human placentas from the 3 million abortions we have performed in this country in the last 3 years. And these placentas, which are so rich in nutrients and hormones, are being used as a base for facial creams for women. And he likens this to the callousness in Germany when they used skin from Jews to make lampshades. In London, there was a scandal recently when it was discovered that the plumper of the fetuses were being sold to soap factories because the fat in those bodies provided a good ingredient for the manufacture of soap. A few weeks ago, a scandal in Washington touched Washington General, D.C. General Hospital, when it was discovered they were selling fetuses. They never made it clear exactly what they were using or selling them for, and the impression was they really weren't interested in what happened there. But they took the funds and they had a separate account which they placed in Virginia. When the money was found, they were asked, what you use these profits for? And they said first they bought a television set for some patients, the patients' recreation room. They used some of the funds to pay the costs of medical meetings. And thirdly, they used the money to buy Cokes and cookies for visiting professors. And then just a few weeks ago in the Los Angeles Times, the tenants of a medical building complained because stacked outside one of the laboratories were boxes. And these boxes, transparent, contained the bodies of over 100 fetuses. They were to go to a factory where there were hundreds more, but they wait until they get them in 100 bunch lots. And the Times said, each in its own transparent, numbered plastic container showing advanced development with tiny hands and feet. And the people protested. They didn't want to look at those 100 bodies. That says something about a society that can tolerate 3 million bodies as long as they can't see them. In 1857, the Dred Scott decision declaring blacks to be non-persons legally to be property to be disposed of at its owner's will was hailed as a landmark decision. The Supreme Court decision of 1973 has been hailed as a landmark decision. Indeed, it is that. But the question is it a landmark to steer by?
Before calling on the individual members of the committee, I would like to introduce them to you. Beginning on the far end, we have Dr. Henry Eggert, who is a professor, practical department, Concordia Seminary in Springfield, soon to be Fort Wayne. Mrs. Mabel Warnke, who has been very active in many facets of synodical affairs, especially in the area of mission work. She's been very active in work with the Braille, and we are very proud of her on the committee because a week from this Friday, she will be receiving the Christus Vivit Award here at Concordia Seminary during her graduation exercises. You know Mrs. Garten, who's secretary of the committee, Dr. Eugene Lindsay, who's a political scientist, teaches at Concordia College in St. Paul, Minnesota. As I indicated earlier, recently testified before the House Subcommittee on Constitutional and Civil Rights. And here we have Dr. Richard Bardoff, chairman of the Department of History at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, and also an expert in constitutional law, and a former member of the CTCR. So we're very pleased to have all of these people here with us, and I've asked them to address themselves briefly in a couple of minutes to areas that they feel need to be touched on, especially as they relate to the role of pastor's counselor. Perhaps we should start as we introduce the individuals and call on our practical professor here, Dr. Eggert, to be our first speaker.
Mr. Chairman, you want to limit this to cases involving abortion, or in general, this topic is so big it just overwhelms a person. I think a pastor always needs to be a counselor. I think that one of the greatest opportunities he has to be a counselor to his whole congregation is when he's in the pulpit on Sunday morning. That ought to be a therapeutic session with the members of his congregation. And certainly he has to make needs to be a dialogical kind of person with whom people are going to be able to speak. And he needs to be a sympathetic person. He needs to be principled. And in the counseling situation, needs to help the counselee see alternatives for action and guide the counselee to make a decision, hopefully, which is in keeping with the will of God. I think he has to be a very responsive sort of person. And he has to do a lot of responsive listening. He has to be able to pick up cues of what this person is feeling and help the person understand himself in relation to long gospel, to be honest with you, the will of God, and responsive, too, to the grace of God. And in particular counseling situations, it's difficult to lead a person to confront himself with the law of God, and it is difficult in some situations, particularly situations of guilt, to have the person accept the free grace of God. Well, I'm just rambling a bit now. I'm going to let somebody else talk, and let's see what the questions are. I was going to relate this to counseling to abortion, but I better let somebody else talk.
Thank you, Sam. I didn't know that Sam was going to do this to us today, and he said brief, so I will be very brief. Perhaps I can give you an idea of what we did at our parish, Emmanuel, in Des Plaines, Illinois. Our pastor had a series of weekly sessions, adult education evenings, they called them, at which we had chaplain
chaplains from our local Lutheran hospital speak to us on all of these subjects, abortion, euthanasia, and the terminally ill. And this is one way we felt the people need to know. It's one thing to say you're for or against abortion, but it's another thing to do something about it if you can. And the first thing you can do is try to familiarize yourself with what is going on, as we've heard such excellent presentations here today. Also, I generally like to try to express my thoughts once in a while in poetry. And as I was sitting here, I gathered some ideas today. If you'll bear with me, I'll just try to read you a few of the thoughts that came to me as our speakers were on the program. Life is a gift from God above to the jewel of his creation. 'Twas given man to use, to serve the Lord of our salvation. But man is led by unbelief to wantonly destroy, by choice, unwanted fetuses of persons, girl or boy. Made in God's image, that is why each person is somebody, and each one counts, for God lives in and truly owns that body. As followers of Christ, we must live so that the world may see that loving, helping others is our responsibility. God give us guidance so that we are led and fortified with wisdom how to have concern for life for which Christ died.
Good.
Do you have another comment or two, if you want to pass
over? I sure don't have a poem. Oh, that was lovely. No, I do have a couple of things I'd like to say about counseling. One is some pastors use that film, The First Days of Life, very effectively. They use it in premarital counseling. They feel it does two things. One is it stresses the positive side of having children, showing the creative activity of God and how we can be co-creators with him. And I thought of that when Dr. Allen was talking about the people who make decisions not to have any. And this film then serves as, you know, a plus. On the other hand, they use it in premarital counseling in order to indicate to the young people what it is they have created in a pregnancy. And so hopefully they will be less hesitant to carelessly or quickly destroy that tiny life. Secondly, there's a temptation in counseling to feed one's ego. I was in a debate one time in which a clergyman was involved, and every question he was asked was, he would answer by saying, but I want to help the woman, and it sounded so compassionate, and there I was defending this voiceless, nameless being that nobody could see, and he was presenting very hard, serious situations and saying, but I want to help the woman. But after it was over, I said, but what about the child? You know, there was nothing. You always said, I want to help the woman. And he flew into a rage, and he said, you don't know what it's like to counsel. You have marital problems year after year after year, and you see no solution. You have juvenile delinquents, alcoholics. He said, nothing. You never seem to make any headway. Ah, but with abortion, a problem pregnancy, I have the solution, and I can solve her problem for her. And so he was very, quite obviously, on an ego trip, although it came out in, was couched in compassionate language. So there's that danger, too, for a counselor, the quick solution, many times because the pastor doesn't have an alternative to offer her. And then the third thing has come out in previous sessions like this, where a pastor reported how women now experiencing guilt don't know quite where to go. They've been to pastors, as you've seen in this film, who have counseled them for abortion. They go back, and the pastor says, well, there's nothing wrong with it. You'll get over it. But deep down, there is something that tells them it's not right. And he encouraged all of the pastors to confront that woman with what she has done in order that she can repent and receive forgiveness. Because as long as we continue to pat her on the head and say, well, it's all in your mind, it's just temporary, it will go away, it's just nothing, she will always carry that guilt. Amen.
Dr. Lindsay?
Sam, I'm going to take off in a little bit different direction. Maybe this isn't good counseling technique, but I think I begin by saying that I expect a counselor to have something to give to a person in a counseling situation. I'm aware of the Rogers technique and the concern about non-directive counseling, but if counseling is only a situation in which the counselee is allowed to explore what his ideas were in the beginning, then there may not have been much of a benefit in that kind of a counseling situation. I think the pastor does well to remember who he is. He is the vehicle through which the word of God, both law and gospel, come to bear on a particularly difficult and trying situation for a human being. And he may very well have to remind the person with whom he is dealing that all of us are shapen in iniquity, and all of us are conceived in sin. And he needs to remind these people as well, and himself as well, that our bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit. That in turn, finally, one doesn't in a society mark worth only in terms of what it is that a person wants. And that there is certainly a concern for the quality of human life that above all our Lord himself expressed, indeed that the Father expressed when he sent his Son into this world to offer him as a life for all of us. There are limits to advice, there are limits to counseling. It may well be that the pastor as a counselor, like other counselors, also has to be aware of what his limits are and what kinds of questions he can't answer. Perhaps he needs also to direct people to those sources to which they can get better answers than those that he has to give. In any event, if the assumption is that what we're doing is finding ways to justify self-indulgence, then it may not be a counseling session that is beneficial either to the person who spends the time on it or the person who apparently is on the end of some kind of counseling advice. I know that this is firm and somewhat directive, but I'd always again put it in the context of saying, we're Lutherans, we're Christians, we're semel Iustus et peccator, all of us at the same time, both the sinful and the redeemed. And within that whole context, both of law and gospel, of a Lord who recognizes sin, but who also forgives the sinner, it would seem to me that that kind of counseling would long-term be the most effective for both pastor and the counselee.
Thank you. Mr. Bardolph?
Mr. Chairman, one of the advantages of being the last in, what is it, five people who are to make opening statements in the panel discussion is one can always say that everything he was thinking of saying has already been said. I won't invoke that advantage, however, because it seems like a cowardly device. But I do confess, though, to being somewhat intimidated by the theme that is assigned, particularly to, I don't mind being assigned to them, but to me, to be cast in the role of giving counsel to pastors on how to counsel makes me a bit uncomfortable. I'm so accustomed to getting my counsel from him rather than telling him how to counsel that I feel as if our roles are reversed here. I'm going to confine myself, therefore, to a single theme, a single aspect of the problem of dealing with people who have this, that kind of problem as they come to their pastors. And I do that, I mean, stick to just one single and limited aspect of it, not because I think you are not up to a more sustained and complicated intellectual effort at this hour, but rather because I am not. At my age, you have to take one thing at a time. If you introduce something that has several parts, you begin tripping over yourself, and you suffer from what I've heard called analysis paralysis. So I'm going to stick to just one specific theme, which I'm going to creep up on from a somewhat unexpected quarter. And that is to suggest that when somebody is involved in something that he's not sure is right, he has remarkable inborn resources for reassuring himself that he is right if he has a particular course of action on which he wants to embark. Let me say that a little more simply. I think the human mind is never more resourceful or more ingenious than it is when it is in the business of self-justification and self-justification. exculpation, you know, shifting the blame to something else or somebody else. That tragic human flaw, that disposition to justify ourselves, expresses itself very early in the human biography. I visited 10 days ago with my little grandson, who was 18 months old, and already I see this propensity arising in him. He had discovered that there's a great deal of fun in just stepping up, clamoring somehow on the end table that adjoins the sofa, and standing on that, he makes a few shouts and dives onto the head first onto the sofa. He was firmly rebuked for that, for obvious reasons. It's manifestly a dangerous thing for him to do. And when it was made clear to his parents that he was not to do that anymore, he didn't do it for an hour or so, and then he sidled up to each of them separately and said, "I'm going to kiss you." And when he had administered that favor upon both of them, he said, "Now I'm going to dive." He was purchasing absolution. I don't have to tell you what's going on there. Well, I think there is a danger, especially when society is becoming so increasingly permissive on the matter of abortion and euthanasia, too, for that matter, that people will begin to confound, that is, confuse sin with legality or illegality. You know, as Gene Barton pointed out earlier today, the law teaches. And when the law condemns something, it is a very easy mental maneuver to persuade yourself that that also attenuates the guilt. That if the law says something's all right, it's all right for me to do it. And I think pastors are increasingly going to have to cope with that kind of judgment that society is increasingly rendering on that question. You see, that it is, in fact, we're making it legal. The Supreme Court itself has now said that states may not make laws that inhibit that right of women to have abortions on demand. And I would argue that it's therefore very important for us and for pastors in counseling with people to help them keep clearly in mind the distinction between sin and crime. They are not the same thing. A lot of things are sinful that are not, by definition, criminal. In fact, it may have occurred to you, it should have come to your attention if you read our document on abortion some time ago, that only 2 of the 10 commandments are the law of the land. It is not illegal to take the name of the Lord in vain. It is not illegal to desecrate the Sabbath. It is not illegal to covet your neighbor's wife. It is not illegal, you know, to bear false witness against your neighbor. There are certain forms of that kind of conduct that may, in some circumstances, be at litigation, but we do not try to make those imperatives that are presented in the Tenth Commandment the law of the land. Further, we also made the point in that document that the 7 deadly sins against which the Christian Church has always been vigorously resistant and which our Lord firmly rebuked are in no case against the law. Not one of them. I happen to write them down because I'm struggling with them every day. But the 7 deadly sins, you know, are pride, that's not against the law. Avarice is not against the law. Nor is anger, nor gluttony, nor lust, nor envy, nor sloth. There you have all 7 of the deadly sins, the ones that the Lord most firmly rebukes. Legality is not the test, but it's easy for people who are caught in a piece of conduct, you see, of which they are perhaps at least somewhat ashamed, or they have some misgivings about it, to exculpate themselves by pointing to the fact that the Supreme Court itself has come out for that particular kind of conduct. I remind you again that the law was not created for the, well, I shouldn't say it that way. The law does not now, whatever it was created for in the first place, the law does not now undertake to try to make men good. It doesn't have that capacity. The gospel can do that, but the law cannot. The law only can set up barriers so that we don't tear each other apart when we disagree or when we have conflicting ambitions or competing aspirations. That's all that the law can do. It does not determine what is good and bad, so that the appeal is no matter what changes are made in the law or what decisions are handed down by the court, is still going to have to be made to higher principles. The sort of thing that Dr. Allen was talking about, to faith and to transcendent sanctions rather than what legislators may have said. The Constitution is not going to get us out of this thing. You know, there is a danger in constitutional forms of government. I'm almost finished. I see my people friends are getting nervous. You know, though it is true that the Constitution is, in a sense, the guardian of our interests and our liberties, it can also cut the other way. In a self-governing society like ours, we can make anything constitutional. And when the principle prevails that it's the Constitution that ultimately is the supreme arbiter of what may and may not be done, you see, you think about the fact that there's no such thing as an unconstitutional amendment to the Constitution. We can add anything to the Constitution and it could never be declared unconstitutional, because when an amendment is added to the Constitution, everything that precedes that language in any degree is to that extent superseded by that new amendment. It is theoretically possible to add, what would it be, the 26th, 27th Amendment to the Constitution, which says all the foregoing is hereby repealed. Then that would be the only Constitution we have got. Don't put your faith in the Constitution. It has to be in God's law and in the gospel. It reminds me uncomfortably of the legendary scientist who once discovered a universal solvent, you know, that would dissolve everything that it touched, everything. Then you are in trouble. There's no container that can hold it. If everything it touches dissolves and becomes that same substance, and it's all, the game is up, you see. Well, constitutions have that kind of built-in capacity, too. We cannot put our confidence in them, not in princes, nor in constitutions. We put it in the law of God. Well, I've said too much.
Thank you. I think you can see that Dr. Baldock has no difficulty holding his own with the pastors and other sort of members of this committee. I should also have pointed out in the beginning that Dr. Martin Charlemagne is a member of this committee and is not able to be present. Before we turn it over to you for your comments and questions, I want to summarize some of the basic principles that I think I heard being expressed here, and if I didn't hear them here, I've heard them in previous workshops on panel discussions on the role of pastor. It seems to me that the first principle that I have drawn is that counseling in this area begins long before the need for specific guidance with respect to an abortion is at hand. Some of the pastors we've had in these panels in the past have indicated that rarely does a young girl or even a family come to a pastor and ask for guidance in the area of abortion. We had Dr. James Mance at a workshop last week in Milwaukee, and he said he's found through his ministry in an inner city parish in Chicago that every year he has fewer and fewer opportunities to counsel young women and young families in the matter of abortion. And so I would have you keep that in mind, that your counseling, your access, your rapport with people, your counseling on this question begins long before the need for specific guidance on the abortion question is at hand. It begins in the whole matter of sex education, in your whole confirmation program, and you're relating to your people in your day-to-day relationships, and you're preaching from the pulpit. There's where you begin and have your contacts with your people. Secondly, whenever you do have the opportunity to counsel in an abortion situation, be prepared to offer alternatives to abortion. One of the sad things about this issue is that it's a sad but true fact that oftentimes abortion is the apparently best answer to a very difficult situation. And many people feel compelled to have abortions because there just do not seem to be any other alternatives. I think Jean alluded to this in her comments, that frequently pastors even become trapped in this because it does sometimes seem to be the best of the possible alternatives at that moment. And it seems to me that if we're really going to be in favor of life, if pastors are really going to be in favor of life, then they're going to have to be prepared to offer alternatives that make life possible and make it easy and advisable for a person who is contemplating that kind of a situation to make that kind of an alternative. Thirdly, we had last week a professional counselor, a clinical psychologist, who made a very good point. We passed out one of his articles that appeared in the CTN back in 1961, Mr. Robert DeVries. And in that article, if you're able to pick it up, if not, you can check it in your back issues. He makes a very helpful distinction that the counselor, the pastor, must learn to distinguish between the counseling situation and a life situation. That we have to be able to, in a counseling situation, develop that kind of trust that enables the other person to be able to expose himself or herself to be able to open up and share their feelings. And he says, this is the counseling situation. And pastor must learn that. At the same time, he must be able to get it across that people do not live in a counseling situation. He gave an illustration of counseling with a young boy who, after some counseling that he had had with him, a number of sessions, the boy said, well, I would like to come and live with you. And he said, well, why do you want to come and live with me? And he said, well, at home, you know, you've got all these rules and all these things that have to be done, and I'd like to live with you because you understand me. And the counselor said, I told him that he would soon want to go back home if he came to live with me because there are rules in my house, too. So I think we have to learn to make that kind of distinction. And finally, the last principle I'd leave with you is the pastor's counselor, the pastor must pray a lot. Most of the counseling that seems to be done today in this area is with people who have already felt the sting and the bite of the law. The kind of counseling that I think we're going to see more and more of is the kind of counseling that comes because an abortion was had some years ago. And somehow they just don't go away. And that kind of person then comes to you. The same counselor we had in Milwaukee said, the best that the counselor can do is to rearrange hell. I think when they said that, the people who were in the workshop almost fell out of their chairs the first time. They said, I say that as a professional counselor. It's only the gospel that can really deal with the root problem that motivates people to come after years and years of having this thing laid heavy on them and wanting some consolation. And so the pastor must pray a lot to have that ability. The 12th has once said, you know, it makes a real theologian to know when to apply law and gospel. When to be able to offer that wonderful consolation that comes through our faith in Jesus Christ that our sins are forgiven, including that which may be weighing very heavy on us about what we may have done. And I would really leave that heavily on you as counselors to be prepared to offer that. So much for some concluding thoughts from us. I want to, at this time, open it up to any kind of discussion that you might have. We have all of 7 minutes left. For any kind of comments on the lower pastor's counselor or on the workshop in general or on any issue that's related to life concerns. From anyone, panel or workshop participants alike.
You know, Sam, sometimes we play little games with words, and I dare say that's one of the things that has bothered me in this kind of a discussion over the years. There was a time when we could say kill. Now we don't. Now we say abort. That's not really as difficult a word. It doesn't convey quite as much of an onus to it. We used to be able to speak of babies. Now we talk of fetuses. Now put the words together, you abort a fetus, but of course you wouldn't kill a baby.
Yes, move the microphone, please.
Burning in my mind is the fact that as I listen to you, you keep telling me that when I become a pastor in a few years, if I make it to this place, that I'm going to, when somebody comes into me, if they come into me, I'm going to have to tell them basically, no, ethically you can't do that. My problem is, and I sympathize with whoever gives the example of the pastor who, Mrs. Garten, about the pastor who had an ego problem. He wants to give these people an answer. And I can tell him, yes, Jesus loves you, and he forgives your sins when you rely on him. But that doesn't solve the problem. What's he going to do about the social stigma? And I heard a little bit of an answer to that question from Dr. Allen, who is alluding to the concept of a loving community. And he really pointed and applied it to himself, which was really beautiful, where he had this said, if you remember, he told that woman that he couldn't, I don't mean to preach a sermon here, I'm going to ask a question in a minute. He told the woman flat out, I'm sorry, I can't take care of your child. And I really sympathize with these women because they've got to compete in this world. You got to get out there and you got to scratch. And how do I tell a woman that, well, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to bite the bullet and have the kid? And I see a possible solution in this loving community. My question is, my other comment. I don't see this kind of loving community in most churches. I'd like to be able to do something to provide that kind of loving community, where this woman could have a child, even after she's made a mistake, possibly, or whatever, with dignity amongst Christians who love her and want to help her. How would you suggest that I could do something like that?
That's a wonderful comment, and I'll call on the panel. Someone would like to respond.
We've got a couple of things to work at, and one is the other guy respecting the sanctity of the life of this child. I think that he has some work to do there with this person. That's number one. And then I suggested before there are alternatives, and so did Sam Napster. There are alternatives for this woman. And I think you have to help her anticipate consequences if she should go through with this thing, in terms of guilt. I think those are three areas at least you need to work with this person. And it's in a scarlet letter, don't you? Hester Prynne, wearing that scarlet A, running around the community and boys who was gay and had a little daughter. What was the little daughter's name? I've forgotten. And old Dinsdale, trying to cover up, had hell on earth. And I think this is a real part of this whole dimension of this person's problem. I don't know if somebody else wants to talk.
There's another direction and dimension to this that we really haven't, and I agree that we haven't talked about it as we might, but I'd be curious to know if anybody here as a pastor has taken up this kind of a question with the elders in this congregation in anticipation of a preparation of a congregation to receive this kind of person together with a child after the fact into that congregation, into the life of that congregation. I'm not the one who's so ready to write off the potential for our congregation responding to the needs of people, whatever those needs are, whether they're in this area, I think that the history and the record of the churches, particularly as it relates to people who are refugees from Vietnam, is an excellent track record. It seems to be the kind of thing in which a person could build, in which this particular social problem also is one to which people can respond and love in a community. Maybe I believe that we need to stimulate and cultivate that dimension of what is available to us among the Christians in a community and in a congregation.
I just simply want to underline the importance of this question's observation. I think that is all too true, what you have said in so many cases, that we have simply, it's very difficult, it seems to me, for many people to really understand the extreme pressure that is on, particularly an unmarried girl, to have an abortion rather than go through the social stigma that is attached to having a child out of wedlock. In our workshop in Madison last week, we had a person there who said after our program, she was going to go back to her congregation and try to organize a group to be specially concerned to be open to help young women in that kind of a situation and to try to work at the very thing that you were drawing attention to, a more loving community. As I tried to indicate in my previous comments, here's where we have to pray once again, isn't it? To draw that line between law and gospel. To be ready to offer that gospel without at the same time giving indication that this is something that is pleasing in God's sight in the first place. And I think we've been maybe a little bit better at preaching the law and administering the gospel in so many of these situations. Are there other...
I may be reckless in saying this, but I have the impression that there is a better prospect of a loving community that surrounds a girl who's in that kind of difficulty. Besides from the experience I've observed in congregation groups which have been identified, I contrast, for instance, the last two cases that were in my immediate, I was about to say experience, I hope you don't draw any false inferences from that, but I contrast them with what was fairly widespread custom when I was a boy, which was admittedly a long time ago, but in the church in which I was brought up, at the time a child was brought to baptism, I see you're dotting our seventh. I was brought up in the Christian Reformed Church, and that is our seventh commandment. You have a different memory. And not only that, but if the child was conceived, and there were people who had a certain fiendish mathematical acuity about that, say, 2 weeks before the marriage, that same procedure was followed. If the child was born, say, a half a month too early, even then the parents would have to confess to the sin against the seventh commandment. Now, that kind of self-righteous and coldness of heart would be unthinkable in any of the congregations I've been in the past. Quite the contrary, we have seen, without condescension, I believe, because I would have been quick to detect it, because I'm looking for it, in people who are unkind in matters of that sort, I've seen without condescension a very easy acceptance and a forgiveness and an assimilation of the mother and her child into the communion with the saints. My major commitment is approaching the experience in the congregations with which I have been identified.
Are there further questions? Yes?
One of the alternatives for abortion would be to put the child out for adoption. And I wonder if there aren't also problems from a Christian perspective with that alternative.
Suppose I came in and wanted to adopt a child, how long would it be that I'd have to wait? And correctly, you'd have to wait some 2 years before you can even adopt a child, should you want to adopt one. So it seems to me that the argument is just a bit specious if it says, look at all of those children that are born into this world that nobody wants. May well be that there are some burdens as far as a particular person is concerned, but if there is some sense of reason to the idea of a loving community, or to mankind, or to the collection of human beings responding to each other's needs collectively, it would seem to me that those opportunities are considerable, that we haven't really begun to explore them, that adoption is certainly a legitimate dimension of how one responds. After all of us are sons by adoption.
I think at the end, if I understood you correctly, you were addressing yourself more to his question. The question was, if I understand it correctly, is there some ethical problem with having a woman give up her child into someone else's care?
Yes. Well, I won't address the ethical aspect of that, but there truly are problems. And we see now the growing concern about making records available to children so they can establish their beginnings. And there's the question of the mother who, searches the crowds to see a child that she thinks might be hers. But we don't know that negative things will result from an adoption. We know that abortion is very, very final. And to say, let's not risk the possibility that the child will always feel like, he has no roots. Let's not risk the possibility that the mother might feel problems about giving up her child. Let's kill him. It's like saying, weren't all those Jews in Germany lucky because they never had to face arteriosclerosis later or something? It seems to me the only way we will know if an adoption does not work out is to give it a try, which is much better, I think, than saying, right out, let's kill the child and not give it a chance for life, and also perhaps deny the mother a chance for growth, because I've seen some very positive things come out of an adoption for the woman who gave up her child.
Jean, I want to add a personal footnote. I have 4 children. My oldest 2 are adopted. And even if they weren't born into my household, I'm glad they were born.
I think that we have come to the end of our workshop on that note. And I would like to thank you for your participation. We hope that you did indeed find this program today one that is helpful to you. and that will be helpful as you go forth in your work, either as a pastor, counselor, or wherever you may be. I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to touch upon the lives of people who are caught up in this question, and as Dr. Allen pointed out so well, we're all caught up into it as much as it's a social issue of our time. Lord, blessings to you.